Good evening. This is Sarah Robinson, host of BBS Radio's Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome our listeners as we continue conversations on the relationship between art and transformation. Tonight I'm joined by Joan Hanley, a practicing artist, college professor, lecturer, expressive arts therapist, and yoga instructor, who's particularly interested in creating public art projects and finding ways to link yoga and art. Welcome, Joan.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Thanks. Tell me where you were born.
Well, I was born in Queens, New York in 1955 to a fireman and a homemaker who was the son of a fireman. So I have this long line of New York firemen.
Wow. Are your parents still living?
My mom is, yes.
And was your father still alive during 9/11?
No, he wasn't. Although I felt very connected just because of all my life watching things like that, knowing that my family were there.
I can imagine. I mean, I felt connected and I didn't have any of those ties that you have. Was creativity and art making a part of your early years?
Well, I mean, I grew up in a working class family. But my parents were very loving and accepting of whatever came from their children. So I began painting very early, and they just embraced it, and they brought me to museums, although they might never have been to them before. And I think their expectation was I would come home from art school, from college, and I would just live with them for the rest of my life making paintings. Of course, I had other ideas at 18.
How many children were there in your family?
Three, and my brother and sister were much more conventional in their choices.
So, you grew up Catholic?
Yes, very Catholic. Irish-American Catholic.
Oh. You have red hair, don't you?
I have red hair, yes.
You're now a very important figure to me because you're the seventh consecutive Catholic guest on the show. And in fact, I have yet to host a show on Conscious Creating with a non-Catholic. So instead of art and transformation, you know, and Conscious Creating, I thought maybe we should start calling this Catholic Creating. What do you think?
Well, some of us are recovering.
Well, I know there are 12-step programs out there for recovering Roman Catholics. But
I like to say my Catholicism is terminal.
And I like to say that I got out early and am Catholic light, L-I-T-E. I'm an Episcopalian. So, do you think that there is any relationship between Catholicism and art, or art making, or the production of artists? Do you think there's anything there?
Well,
intuitively,
ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I know as a child, I spent a lot of time in church, and it's a very visual place. Our church, Our Lady of Victory, had a huge statue of the Virgin Mary with her head on the crushing a snake, her foot crushing the head of a snake that was releasing an apple, I think. You know, it's just very strong.
That's a really strong image.
Yeah.
that's a scary image.
Yeah, well,
possibly.
You could tell she was was a powerful Mary, yes. You know, and I think what I will say for Catholicism is it has always been, right, connected to the arts, and there is no prohibition against making images in Catholicism, and that's helpful as an artist.
I didn't think of that. That's right. And then the musicians are inspired by the great music and the words of the Latin Mass that many of us grew up with. So, you know, all very moving. In 1970, you began practicing yoga and meditation in a Catholic high school. And, you know, this seems a little incongruent to me. Tell me about it.
Well, I think I was lucky in being in New York City because the Catholicism that I was raised in was very liberal. And the men and women around me were very intelligent and open-minded, extremely active politically and socially. In particular, there were two monks who came to my high school to teach religion. They had been cloistered in the Midwest and had been studying the Bhagavad Gita and also reading Thomas Merton.
Mm.
And they knew that masters were coming from the East to New York and were teaching publicly, and they wanted that experience. The Catholic Church, being the well-run organization it is, you know, gave them a job. Will you go live at this, you know, convent and rectory and teach these, you know, teach religion? So when they arrived, we took all the furniture out of the religion room, and we would sit on the floor, and they taught us as they were learning. So we learned to chant Om, and we learned to meditate on a candle. We learned to witness our thoughts. We, you know, all of the sort of traditional Vipassana meditation techniques. I spent my high school religion class studying.
It's amazing. Did you also study art in high school?
Yes. At that time in New York, even you could be an art major, and we were taking regent exams then. I don't know.
In prep school, you could be an art major?
In any school, there was a regent track for art, so I would send a portfolio to Albany once a year to, you know, instead of taking certain tests, other people. You know, I still had to take certain curriculum in academics, but it was limited to give me more space to study art.
Mm.
And, of course, New York City was a wonderful place. The museums in those days were all free on Wednesdays. So Wednesday we would spend in the museum studying art, you know, being in the presence of, you know, some of the greatest works of art in the world.
You were very fortunate to be born in that time and place.
I was, yes. It had its downsides.
Well, I'm sure.
As all things do, but it was a great preparation. And at the time that I learned those meditation techniques, and I'll certainly say this to any of your listeners who are adolescents or, you know, any parents who are witnessing their children dabbling in many things, it meant nothing to me. You know, I was just another class. I, you know, put in a medium amount of effort and participated and daydreamed. And it was, I did not recognize it at that time as something special. In fact, I was also doing silent Christian retreats at that time, which seemed more dramatic to me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I became a young adult and started to face the tests of life, those meditation techniques just came rushing back to me as the solution to many problems which to a 20 or 21-year-old seemed insurmountable.
So at that point, you really were not making the connection between the yoga and art. They were separate activities for you.
Absolutely. I wasn't, you know, I was very interested in art, and I think I had a much more modernist perspective. Being exposed, you know, this was 1970 maybe, you know, 1971,
right.
I was being exposed to modernist thought in art, and was I was thinking of art as something that was quite separate from everything else, and I had always been in religious practice, so I took it for granted. I just, you know, participated, but I didn't realize then what an important moment that was for me. And, of course, now almost every day, certainly every week, I thank those two monks for that introduction.
We never know what will influence us, do we?
know, in hindsight, the path of your life is, you know, you can see how it all connects, but sometimes in the process of it, it's hard to really know what the important moments are.
Especially in high school, I think. You and I both have children of high school age, and I think they're fortunate in the sense that because you and I do see this big web, we can ask the right questions sometimes to get them thinking. But I didn't have that growing up. I don't know if you did. We just sort of were on go. They pushed the go button and we went.
No, my parents were not. My mother did notice I had this. I would get very removed during meditation. When I was in grammar school, they would bring us all to Mass, you know, on the holy days. And I would come out of the church and forget to go back in the school. I'd just come home in the middle of the day, and there I'd be on the steps.
Mm.
Which I think was quite frightening for my mother that I would get so disoriented in the religious experience. So she actually didn't approve of the silent retreats for the same reason. I'd come home and for a couple of days, you know, they felt they should nail me down, you know.
Mm, you were a budding mystic, and that wasn't the right thing to be at that time. So then in your 20s, you attended, was it a women's camp in Arizona where you began studying Kundalini yoga? And who was Yogi Bhajan?
Oh, Yogi Bhajan was one of those masters who came east in the late 60s and began teaching freely to white people and black people, you know, to Americans who would have been considered untouchables because we weren't of the Brahmin caste in India. So even in India, we would not have received these techniques. Traditionally, they were guarded by particular sects, particular families, particular places. But somehow these masters got the message, you know, these practices need to be taught freely, and came and made the sacrifice to leave their families or bring their, in Yogi Bhajan's case, he came alone and brought his family later. And he began teaching openly many techniques which had never been taught openly to anyone before. And he taught them to anyone who wanted them without initiation. He said, the times had changed. You should initiate yourself. Do the practice and, you know, discern for yourself if these techniques work and how they'd be in your life.
So he didn't set himself up as a guru?
No.
In the sense that we know guru in modern parlance?
No. And Yogi Bhajan is a Sikh, which is a fairly contemporary religion. It began in the 1400s and 1500s in India. And in the Sikh religion, the only guru is the scripture. So there is no... As he taught us about his religion, the Sikh religion, he would never consider himself a guru. He was just a man on the level with anyone else, although we noticed he was quite an extraordinary man.
Did you feel, now that you have the language to describe it, do you feel he was an avatar or an enlightened one, or how would you describe him in terms of that sense?
Well, his message was very strong that we are all enlightened ones.
Yes.
And that we all have the possibility of noticing that we are divine. I think for me, the summer that I went to New Mexico and meditated with Yogi Bhajan for the first time, I felt that I had, all my wires had been reconnected.
Hmm.
You know, I felt that child who would forget where she was sitting in church in Queens, New York, was back again. And I was still my adult self, or young adult self, but something had been reconnected that from that point on never went away. So perhaps that is the remarkable experience of when we're given the blessing to meet a real spiritual teacher, even if they are not a guru.
Do you think that one's process of awakening or coming to know who we are is can be facilitated or quickened by the presence of another enlightened person like Yogi Bhajan?
Yes, and also by many other things, by the presence of scripture, by the presence of compassion, of natural beauty. So it does not have to be in the form of another person, I think. As Thomas Merton said, you know, in this day and age, none of us will be delivered by a church or an institution. We each need to deliver ourselves.
Yes.
But Yogi Bhajan was extremely important to me, and I feel very blessed to have met him and have received the technologies and tradition he gave me, which is why whenever I have an opportunity, I pass that on. And I pass it on exactly as he taught it to me, without any reinvention.
No ego that goes along with it to create it as yours.
Well, my ego is always there.
Yes.
But I know.
You know what I mean. I'm thinking
absolutely.
In terms of contemporary gurus. There just seems to be a lot of ego sometimes that formulates truths in a way that I believe sometimes make other people dependent on the individual giving the truths.
Yes.
And
that's scary
to me.
Yes, one of the really important things that Yogi Bhajan taught me in terms of teaching yoga is he said, always imagine that you are creating teachers, not students.
Mm.
That he always said himself, he wasn't interested in creating students. He was interested in creating teachers. And he said, when you encounter your student, focus on what is good about them and imagine they will be 10 times greater than you.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I started teaching, someone suggested that I assume that a little Plato is in my classroom, so that I'm humbled and realize that I'm just a conduit for truth that will eventually be discovered by that individual, and probably more quickly than I would discover it.
That's great.
So, you are also known as Hari Kiran. How did you get that name?
This is a name that Yogi Bhajan gave me, a spiritual name. Hari is one of the many names in Sanskrit for God. It refers to the creative feminine aspect of the divine. And Kiran means light, not a big light like the sun, but a beam of light, like a flashlight, something that would cut through the darkness.
Do you relate to those images on a very personal level?
Yes, I consider this my job description.
And the creative feminine, I love that. Do gender images come up in your artwork? Are you influenced as the creative feminine?
Yes. I am very pleased to be incarnated as a woman. It's a fabulous thing to be a woman in this day and age. Also, it has great challenges. Those of us who are raising daughters, probably we know this in ourselves and certainly encounter it freshly. I am very interested in what our generation of women can offer having known the suffering of our mothers and our grandmothers,
yes,
and seeing the possibilities of our daughters.
And did these images manifest in your art at all?
My work is quite figurative. And at times abstract, but my painting practice has lots of figures in it. For instance, I paint some Buddhas that are very feminine,
mm-hmm.
or I paint images of women meditating, divine images of women. Now, I mentioned that fabulous, Virgin Mary that I grew up with her foot touching the head of this snake with fangs. I think it's important for us to have images of feminine divinity,
mm-hmm.
Just as it is important to have images of masculine divinity.
Yes.
Certainly, my experience of divinity is that it is beyond gender, and all gender, and perhaps we are actually subtly many gendered beings,
right,
at the same time as we are mostly one gender.
Mm-hmm. I'm a playwright, and I am interested in the feminine aspect of the divine, only because in creating images for others of that creative feminine, I feel we challenge people to perhaps look beyond. It's not that we're saying, God is a woman or anything like that. It's just, well, could we look at the feminine aspects as well as the masculine aspects? So as an artist, I do think that's important for me anyway. But it sounds like... I know I've seen The Bowing Woman. That painting is quite beautiful that you have on your website.
Well, it's very important for us all to learn to bow. Mm. That's for sure. I don't have so much control about the images that come forth when I'm painting.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do feel a great responsibility, as you said, about the images that I put out into the world, I'm quite conscious of my own image that I make. And I think we each create an image every morning just when we get dressed.
Mm.
We communicate how we feel about being women, and we walk that image out into the world. So we are all creating images of the divine feminine, and expressing how we feel about that each time we get dressed.
Yes, every human being.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'll have to think about that more. If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating, I'm talking with visual artist and yoga instructor Joan Hanley. You've made the statement that you don't see a conflict between Catholic tradition and the practice of Eastern spiritual discipline. Can you expand on that?
Well, as we have been discussing, Sarah, as a child, I was introduced to Eastern spirituality by Christian, the Catholic monks.
Right.
So just from the beginning, it was presented to me not as a conflict, but as an enhancement. And as I, each of us are making our way in the world, we never really leave our past. For myself, I very much feel my ancestors for who the Catholic tradition was a source of great joy and strength. And that belongs to me. And I don't want to let those grandmothers go. And I don't want to let those grandmothers down.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't want to drop the very preciousness that is held in the gospel stories, the wisdom that is held in Gregorian chant, I don't want to put those things down. At the same time, I feel I'm an adult and I have I need to make my own ethical and moral decisions in the world. And I sometimes, as a contemporary woman, very much disagree with positions that my church takes. But I don't want to throw out the tradition because of my marriage to Catholicism is through those grandmothers. And I'm not willing
that.
Yeah.
It's a great image. My marriage to Catholicism is through those grandmothers.
And then on the other hand, I feel in this life I have been given a great gift to know a spiritual master, to be his student, and receive from him all of this technology. And he, as I said, very much said, I don't want you to focus on me. Take this and just share it with anyone who wants it, you know, anyone who you think it might be able to help. And also practice yourself, you know, practice deeply. So for 35 years, I have had a very intense practice of this yoga, enhanced by also studying Vipassana, also studying Iyengar and Ashtanga and Vinyasa yoga. And so all of that for me actually has allowed me to stay in relationship to my Catholicism. It has encouraged me not to be judgmental and not to be dualistic, but to embrace my whole self, to embrace all of my possibilities, and to have compassion for human traditions and forms that may not be perfect, but are still full of intergenerational wisdom that I cannot create the depth of wisdom in either of those traditions in my lifetime. It just took thousands of years.
The way I think about it and express it, having been a student of many traditions and also a yoga student for many years, is that I am a part. I am a cultural Christian as well. That I'm raised by many generations of Christians, and I speak the language of Christianity not only with my lips but in my heart and my very being. And to reject that because of perhaps misinterpretations or misuse of Christian concept just doesn't feel right to me. So following other truths and other disciplines seems like a complement to my faith. And sometimes I have trouble in the liturgy listening to language and saying words that don't feel right for me, and then I just have to reimagine them. Maybe I could think about those words this way. Do you actually practice still? As do you go to church, for example, in Eucharist?
I go to church when I can find a community where I feel at home, mm-hmm. and the liturgy feels right to me. And when I can't find that, then I continue my pursuit of Catholicism in my own quiet way at home.
Yes.
So as a family, we sort of pulse in and out. We were able to find beautiful communities for our children to be baptized in and receive their first communion. Abraham was confirmed in Ireland in a, you know, just a really terrific way.
Mm.
And now my daughter is ready to be confirmed and has actually made the decision that she would like to consider Eastern vows rather than Catholic confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And at 14, I think that all I can do is respect her and support her in that inquiry of what vows, of what commitments will best support her in her spiritual life.
Yes, I think that takes a lot of respect for your child, and I have thinking children as well, particularly the elder daughter is very self-reflective and has at various times talked about Judaism and Buddhism and other, whatever the religion she's studying at the time, she sees truth in it. And I did encourage her to go through with confirmation in our own tradition, the Christian Church, simply because I felt that it was symbolic and an important sort of rite of passage. But I did say, when you leave our home, you know, feel free to pursue anything that works for you. So I didn't have quite the courage you have. It's difficult to make these decisions when they come to one, I think.
It is difficult. And also, you know, I have a very strong-willed daughter.
No.
So, and I also, I really respect what she says. I think for us, still being part of the Catholic Church, that, you know, the Catholic Church is quite strong at the moment.
Yes.
In its criticism of those who want to practice Eastern traditions.
Yes.
And I can see that my daughter's meditation practice is sustaining her. So it wouldn't really be wise as a mother to put her in a position where she might need to surrender.
No. And every family is different and every individual soul is different. We find the place where we need to be. How has yoga informed your work as an artist, or vice versa?
Well, I think that the person who gets up in the morning, for me, the version of Joan Hanley who gets up in the morning and practices and tunes herself to the divine and listens and calms and clears, and that person goes into the studio and is such a different person.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, my family are really great about letting me practice yoga because they say I'm so much nicer when I do.
And what time is it that you get up? I think I know the answer to this question. When do you rise?
I get up very early. I get up this morning I think it was 4:20. And I take a cool shower, and I say a long poem prayer to tune myself to that vibration in the that's available then in the early morning. And then I do an hour of yoga, and then an hour of chanting meditation.
And so the person who goes into her yoga practice, as you said, is very different from the person who later walks into her studio, because you're more grounded?
It's like the shower, I think. I'm just washed off a bit. And that is the real blessing of a spiritual practice, whatever one's practice is, to be able to connect to that infinity of us, rather than to our finite identity that is holding so many contractions. When we tune to that infinite, that hari, that creative flow, is present.
Yes.
We still need, you know, our finite personality to, especially in the public art, you know, you need a lot of very finite skills to get to the end of the project, but it is that, it's riding that infinite wave of creativity.
Did you say intimate or infinite?
Infinite.
Infinite.
Infinite, yeah.
Yes. I would like to think that I could get up at 4:20 and do that, but I just, that's not me. I do have rituals, though, and breathing before I begin to write, and perhaps you're right, that's, it's like a shower. It cleanses the debris that I've collected from interactions and takes me into another world. It's a portal, really.
Well, you know, Sarah, the breath in many traditions is used in this way. It is the breath that connects our subtle body to our physical body. And we're alive because in our physical bodies because we have the breath. And when the breath stops, we won't be there anymore. Right? So many traditions recognize that breathing is a way that we can connect that finite self, that self that's in time and space, with that self that is beyond time and space.
And there's the yoga teacher telling us about breath. This is the great thing about my yoga instructor. Always reminds me to breathe.
Yeah.
Breathe. And that is so important. And then the asanas become a metaphor for life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fascinating. You hold several academic degrees in art, a BA from the University of Harvard's Harvard Art School, an MFA from Vermont College, and an MA in expressive therapies from Lesley College. Now, I've interviewed several individuals who call themselves art therapists. How does an expressive arts therapist differ from an art therapist? Or is there a difference?
Well, the expressive art therapy training actually came about in a very practical way in Massachusetts. And I guess this was similarly happening in other parts of the country, but I know it in particular because that's where my degree and training was at Lesley College. Mental health had gotten into these very big hospital environments, and some conclusions were made as for many of these individuals with mental handicaps could make much more progress and by moving into smaller environments. So suddenly, instead of having an art therapist and a music therapist and a poetry therapist and a drama therapist, they have this idea, well, why don't we take one artist and we will educate them in all of these modalities.
Hmm.
And they brought together a very interesting faculty at that time, which includes Sean McNiff, who is known for his art therapy, Paolo Camille in music therapy, Norma Canna, who's one of the mothers of movement therapy in America, and James Hillman, to kind of revision and make a very strong psychological imaginative base for all of this. And we moved from one modality to another. What we discovered, both in our own practice and in our practice with our clients, is that being able to move from one modality to another was amplifying and enhancing. And it was much more than that practical reason to have one individual who knew all these things. It was really just that when you took the psychodrama and made a drawing, and took the drawing and made a poem, that you were going deeper and deeper into the image and moving farther and farther away from perhaps an explaining, judging mind and deeper into the realm of the imagination so that the image was becoming amplified rather than reduced. And more healing, more therapeutic through that amplification.
And so you are trained in all of those modalities.
I am, yes. Fascinating.
I I was doing workshops that I created without knowing what expressive arts therapy is in the different modalities as well. And not for therapeutic purposes as much as for tapping into creativity and connecting spirit with art making. And love to learn more about that at some point. I'm sure you can be a good resource for that.
Well, you know, we really didn't invent this at all. We rediscovered it. The traditional shaman or healer would easily move between these realms, responding to the realm of the imagination. It's only that in our modernist way, we had separated them. And because of this practical reason, they came back together again.
Hmm. One of the through lines in the stories of most of my guests and is an experience of success, or to use Jung's term, inflation, early in life, followed by a period of dark night of the soul where the individual feels he or she's failed, and then later, hopefully, and in the case of the guest I've talked to, an awakening that led them to an unexpected path of joy and healing and peace. Can you relate to this mythic journey?
I can, in the sense, Sarah, that as I told you, when I first learned to meditate, it didn't mean much to me. And then at 20, when I got my BFA and moved to New York City and in a tenement apartment on the Lower East Side and began working for the Village Voice and trying to exhibit my paintings and trying to have a successful life as a 20-year-old woman artist and make a living, I found myself being more and more drawn into drugs and alcohol and relationships that didn't feel good to me. And that spiraled quickly down into a place where I felt I couldn't make a success in the way that I had originally envisioned it. I imagined I could move to New York and somehow I could sell my paintings at 20 and, you know, have a studio. Mm-hmm. And I imagined that somehow I would have love relationships with partners who would, you know, treat me well, and none of that was, it wasn't working. And the way that I was relaxing from those stresses was through drugs and alcohol. And I just felt how dangerous that moment was. One morning I woke up, I had fallen out of my loft bed. I could tell by the bruises, but I didn't even remember doing it. And I felt at that moment there were two paths, that I could probably make a go of this life in New York, but it was going to cost me dearly at that moment. And, or I could go and look for that path of the meditation, that inner path. And I decided to leave New York, go back to Connecticut, where I knew I could work as an art director and a less demanding environment, spend more time painting alone, and find an ashram and begin studying. And I took that path, which at that moment felt to me like walking away from the center of the art world.
A renunciation.
Yeah. I mean, I was living on Prince Street in Soho. I thought I was in the center of the universe.
You were a cool chick. With bruises on her pretty white skin.
Right. And I just, it wasn't, something in me said, okay, we're going about this, we're going to do this, we're going somewhere else. And at that time, I really felt I was walking away from the traditional art practice. I came to Connecticut and I began studying art and yoga.
Was this after you had been to Arizona with Yogi?
Next summer after moving to Connecticut, I met Yogi Bhajan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so interesting. I think this is very true about being on a spiritual path. If you take one step towards your soul, mm-hmm. it will come running to you.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to take that step. And it often asks for a sacrifice. And for me, it was giving up my little loft on Prince Street. And really, because of I knew the lifestyle wasn't going to make me the person I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So what good would the success of the paintings be?
So what did that, in that moment on the floor, where did that idea about following the path of meditation, where did it come from?
I have no idea. As I said, I hadn't really thought about those experiences.
Right.
I just sort of carried them on, but I wasn't really thinking about them close at hand. In fact, when I was in that loft on Prince Street, that was exactly where I was aimed all through art school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just what I thought I needed. But once there, I thought it would destroy me.
Mm. I've had a similar, not maybe as dramatic, but an experience of, you know, the platitude and be careful what you ask for because you may get it, and having some success as an actor, and then having to come to a crossroad where I either would go in one direction, at this point it would be renouncing intimacy with my family and my husband, you know, to go off to England and do a show in the West End in London, or to re-embrace the family and the children. And now it seems, well, of course I would be with my family and my children. But at the time, it was tough. I had to get beat up before I could make that decision. So I really relate. Really relate. And thank God we are awakened at some point to go on to the path where we need to be.
Well, many traditions say we came here to face that test. We came here to face the test of time and space and choose the soul.
And the bruises hurt, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
And the memory of the bruises
hurts.
The memory of the bruises hurt. And for me, the only way out of a spiral of darkness or shame about those bruises is to just stay on the path.
Yes, and the falling offs are so valuable.
Yes.
That is really where we learn our compassion.
Yeah, you're right.
And which I think is the most important lesson of this life, mm-hmm. the greatest blessing of this life is to be able to develop compassion.
Yes. You've said, and I'd like to quote you here, as a yogini, I connect the practice of postures and meditations to how I live and move in the world. I want to bring art practice out of the studio to places where visual art can contribute freedom, beauty, revelation, and conviviality. Beautiful statement. Is this your intention with new genre public art?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is really the most exciting thing going on in this world with art practice. Artists are moving, and it is not exclusive, of course. I still love to be in my studio and make those precious little things. You know, it doesn't mean you need not to do that, but to as artists, we can stay content in society and culture as it is, or we can move our role as cultural producers into a place of service where we can hope that images can heal, that people can meet and communities can form, constituencies can be empowered, those without voices can benefit from those of us who know how to express and use different media, whether those medias are radio or film or theater or painting, sculpture. You know, Joseph Boy showed us a sculpt. It is a sculpture to collect a group of people. I mean, I can. My yoga studio, on some level, is a social sculpture. You know, it is a display on Main Street in Wilton of people meditating together, practicing, making that choice. It is a visual aesthetic image, even though it's very temporary.
Could you just define very quickly new genre public art so our listeners know what we're talking about? If that's possible.
Quickly. It is considered part of visual art, and it uses both traditional and non-traditional media. Artists in this way communicate and interact with a broader spectrum of peoples than they would just through a museum or a gallery. So it has a public appearance that would be access a bigger audience. Generally, it's about issues directly relevant to that audience's life, and it could be as small as as defined as perhaps someone working with adolescents who feel they don't have a place, or homeless people who actually don't have a place and are being driven into being invisible, or my friend Brian McGuire's work where he is giving art supplies to those in solitary confinement in prisons, so that those of us who are moving through this society, not realizing, oh, one of the things we do is put people in solitary confinement, are confronted with the voice, the image, the vision of that person who we're connected to, who is in that experience. So the new genre artist, why we call it new genre public art is so you
did
know.
Did you coin that, or is that?
No, you know, there's a couple of people trying to think. It may be Suzanne Lacey, who's a terrific arts activist, new genre public artist.
It doesn't matter. I'm just curious.
Yes. It is a term that came about in the late 70s, maybe even early 70s, and has been used since then to differentiate public art, you know, the sculpture with the fountain or the guy on the horse.
Right.
You know, which are also wonderful.
Sure.
In their context.
Sure.
Not that we should stop making sculptures and fountains, but this new genre public art is generally more temporary. It will appear and disappear, and it has to do with reaching artists, visual artists, taking these forms to reach broader audiences.
And it feels more interactive to me as well.
Yes, absolutely. That would be so that it is generally not authored by one person.
Right.
So there's a collaborative aspect in the production of it, and it also offers itself to the public for collaboration. So the piece is completed or even made in some way by the public involvement.
Collaboration seems to be an important theme in your life, and I'd like to hear about your work with your friend Susan Brown, specifically Axis Mundi, and then you could use that as an example of the new genre of public art, and then your gallery and yoga studio.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that, Sarah. I'm lucky to have Susan Brown, a good friend of mine, to collaborate with. She also has a private painting practice. We both have our separate studio work. This piece, Access Monday, we came together to do for the Wilton Arts Festival a couple of years ago.
And that's Wilton, New Hampshire.
That's Wilton, New Hampshire. It was a site-specific piece. So this term, site-specific, is also one of the, you know, a contemporary term in art practice where the piece is about where it's being installed. So in this sense, you're not making the man on the horse and then, or making some sculpture, big sculpture, outdoor sculpture, and then whoever buys it puts it in their plaza, you know, or their, you go to the place and the piece actually comes out of the place.
Mm.
So our place was a lot downtown Wilton on the river, and we went to explore this place and found signs that teenagers hung out there. We found, you know, keychains with anime little faces on it. other things that I probably won't say on the radio.
Okay. I get the picture.
This place actually already belonged to someone in a certain way. So the first thing that Susan and I did was we decided we would come there every day for 40 days and do a meditation. We just sit. And this is an example. Now, if we sat at home, perhaps it's just meditation, but if you decide to sit downtown in a lot tainted with arsenic, this is also a visual statement. And some of my students would come and sit with us. And also, after a while, the young people who hung out in this place became interested and started asking questions. And on a fine day, we might have 30 people sitting on the river meditating.
But I did see a photograph of the two of you with umbrellas on a day that we could not describe as fine.
When it poured rain, generally it was just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I get this inspiration from John Cage, the composer and artist John Cage.
Mm-hmm.
I love to make a structure like I'm going to sit here for 40 days and then just live through it and see what comes from that structure.
Amazing.
And some of the things that came in that structure is local artists were interested. We cleaned up the site because when you start meditating somewhere, after a while you just want it to be nicer. I mean, it wasn't really, we didn't plan it, but all of a sudden rakes were appearing and people were cleaning up this lot. And we found all this like weird metal and stuff, and we thought, that's interesting.
Mm.
So then I called my friend John Brooks, who's an internationally known sculptor, and he came down and helped the kids and us. We made these great sculptures out of the debris. And we also had video going all whenever we were there. And the young people loved the camera, liked using the camera. And so we wound up with tons of footage taken by all different people.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And when it was time, now I always try to have a gallery installation as part of these public works because I want the intervention in the social sphere, but I also want the intervention in the art sphere.
Right.
I want to be bringing the world into the art sphere. So we have this gallery. And we had all this video, and Susan and I, of course, you know, we have one monitor each. I said, well, what are we going to do? So we said to the kids, okay, we want to show your video, but you need to bring in a television.
That's
so
great.
All these kids went home and convinced their families to be without their TVs for the weekend so that we could have this gallery that had 17 TVs in it. all playing the footage of people meditating.
That is just amazing.
I hate
that we're running out of time. We need to talk more about this, and I don't want to cut you off, but may I please say also just that you did go, in January, you and Susan did open a gallery and art studio on Main Street in Wilton, New Hampshire. So I hope the listeners, if they go to New Hampshire, will come visit. And that you have collaborated on a soulful level with your husband, Thomas Moore, the writer and musician, and specifically on Original Self, the 2001 book where you did illustrations and printmaking. Joan Hanley, thank you for talking with me tonight. I really enjoyed our conversation and hope that we'll have a chance to continue this dialogue. We have a lot to say and talk about.
Yes. Well, thanks a lot, Sarah. Thank you for the work you're doing bringing this information out to the world. It's a real service.
I encourage our listeners to learn more about Joan's work by visiting her website at www.artandyoga.com. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating this and every Thursday evening. We hope you'll visit our website at www.consciouscreating.com to learn more about the show, my art, and to give us your thoughts on what you heard tonight. Conscious Creating is made possible through my collaboration with Susan Pearson, associate producer, and the generosity of Donald and Doug Newsom at BBS Radio. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.